Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay, the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session, pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you, be seated. Court has five causes on its oral submission docket this morning. In the order, and this afternoon, the order of their presentation is as follows. Kathleen Gresham Dreyer is next friend of Alexander Davern Dreyer and Austin Gresham Dreyer versus Philip S. Green from Harris County. In the interest of JWT, a minor child from Newton County, Allied General Agency, Inc., and John Michael Poland versus Jerry C. Moody from Dallas County combined for oral argument with Golda A. Lyons versus the Miller's Casualty Insurance Company of Texas from Dallas County. And National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh versus Justo L. Dominguez Jr. from Reeves County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted a certain portion of time for petitioners and respondents or relators and respondents to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a certain portion of this time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these causes. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If you desire to listen to a tape of these arguments, you may make application with our clerk. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Dreyer versus Green.
May it please the court, Mr. Eugene Smith will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please this honorable court. The court is up. Familiar with this case, as I'm well aware, and as much as you reviewed the briefs beforehand, you of course recognize it is no accident that you're hearing arguments in both JWT in this case today, and as much as they're the opposite sides of the coin of presumption. For purpose of this appeal, the respondent, Philip Green, is the father of these children. There's no question that can be raised about that as a dismissal in trial court. At no time in the brief is it even denied. Indeed, the whole case rests upon what amounts to the presumption of biological paternity, which is contained in Section 1202 of the Family Code, which we will point out has many more presumptions in it, each conflicting. The presumption of biological paternity is just nothing more than, once more, the presumption of legitimacy wearing new clothes in a new bottle, perhaps. The presumption that the husband of the mother is the father of the child and bars the suit by the biological father under Section 1301, operates only against the biological father, not the child, or the state, of course, in your decision, Justice Carnan's court's decision, Levan. The child has standing to sue under Section 11.03, specifically granted just as the state, as a governmental entity, is given standing under Section 1103, in our opinion, bringing it under Levan.
Counsel, could you speak up just a little bit?
I'll try to, Justice Doggett. If one looks at this presumption upon which they are relying, let us think what it does. First, it applies only if the mother is married. In no other circumstance will it ever apply. It does not apply if the father is married. She may sue him. It does not apply if the husband or the mother, either one, seeks to deny paternity under Section 12.06. They may both bring a suit to deny their paternity, either by divorce or in denial of a claim for support. If we try to expand this to include the children in this case, what we are doing is saying that in that single instance in which the mother of a child is married to someone other than the biological father of the child, the biological father of the child will be foreclosed, as you will hear argued in JWT later, and the child will be foreclosed as well. Let us think what that means in terms of what the child is being denied. The child, of course, will be denied the right of support. But more than that, there are death rights involved as well. The child would equally well be denied the inheritance rights of the child. The child would not be able to establish if this presumption and the preclusive effect of 1301 is allowed to establish that the child is indeed the father, the heir of the father. The child would not be qualified for pretermitted heir status, pretermitted child status, in the event there is a will. The child would be excluded from a class devised to children. Indeed, if there is a will drawn, the child would not qualify. The illegitimate child would not qualify. Would be denied a family allowance under the probate code. Would be denied homestead rights under the probate code. Would be denied workman's compensation death benefits. Would be denied insurance death benefits. Proceeds of a life insurance policy, which is when it goes to the children of the insurer. Wrongful death would be denied to the child. Survivorship rights would be denied to the child. And of course, in the event of the father of the child, the father of the child would be denied the right to consortium, a very precious right.
Of course, those are all consequences, legal consequences flowing from the legal relationship, but here they are afforded those rights legally as the, at least it's argued, as the adjudicated children of Thorndryer, are they not?
These are not the adjudicated, in our opinion, Your Honor, they are not the adjudicated children.
I understand,
obviously.
Yeah, I understand that's the,
that's the
argument. But,
they are
afforded those benefits if, in fact, they are the legal children of Thorndryer, are they not?
From Thorndryer, but not from their biological father.
Right.
Yes, sir.
Alleged violence.
Beg your pardon?
Alleged violence.
For the purpose of this appeal, the biological father, Your Honor.
Well, no. did the children seek to disestablish Dwyer's paternity in the suit that they filed in addition to alleging Green's paternity?
We served process upon Thorndryer, theory being that he would have the opportunity to appear and to establish his own paternity if he wished to, Your Honor. We did not expressly pray for the disestablishment of paternity. Obviously, the establishment of the paternity would either give him two fathers, as in the Vargas case, which seemed to be the conflicting presumptions, and the necessary establishment of Phil Green as the father would be the disestablishment of paternity, just as it would be in Levan, as I read Justice Carney's opinion in Levan, in which the petition was given broad range to disestablish paternity, and in which the court, this honorable court said, which I think is dispositive, and as much can be made of this, what it really comes down to, as far as this court is concerned, is the divorce decree going to preclude this suit by virtue of some principle of res judicata? We feel that there is no question that they should not. Attorney General against Ridge and Levan both seem to us to indicate that they would not be preclusive.
Of course, Levan, the child wasn't mentioned in the divorce decree there.
Correct, Your Honor.
The twins were mentioned in this decree.
They were, Your Honor.
What public policy would be favored by having us adopt your position?
I suppose, Your Honor, that since biology seems to reign supreme these days, that all we can say at this point is that to the extent that public policy considerations are involved, we get on a slippery slope. If we say that this is disruptive to the family, when we say that, we have to say that there is some kind of family we're talking about. This presumption operates in such a way as to preclude a situation such as this. The husband and wife have been separated for years. Perhaps the wife does not even know that she's still married to the husband. She begins living with someone else, or worse yet, she marries someone else. In that situation, you have a stable, ongoing, long-lasting relationship. And this presumption would operate to preclude the father, in that case, from establishing his own biological paternity. In our case, of course, is not that sort. But if we look across the spectrum of possibilities which exist in this case, all we can say is that at some point, somebody has to have the opportunity to establish this right. Presumption, Stanley against Illinois, a wonderful case for the Supreme Court, the landmark case, is to some extent relevant here because in Stanley, the Supreme Court had to determine whether the father of an illegitimate child was automatically to be classified as unfit for purposes of dependency. The presumption in Illinois was, of course, the child was going to be awarded the state because the father was illegitimate. Justice White said procedure by presumption is always a very efficient way to go, but it may deny some fundamental rights. We believe that there is a fundamental right of the child to establish its own biological parentage. That is an important issue with the child and is recognized in the cases.
In this case, Alexander could sue by himself, and then I take it if he won or lost.
I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
Alexander could sue And if he won or lost, his twin brother Austin could sue at some later time.
That's true, Your Honor.
Nothing to preclude that.
There's nothing to preclude that, no.
What is to preclude the possibility of conflicting results in those circumstances?
There's nothing to preclude as far as the two twins?
Yes.
There would be certain, if collateral estoppel would preclude, Your Honor.
So you could have possibly three fathers in this case. The father in the divorce decree and the father in each of two paternity suits.
Yes, Your Honor. You could have more than that. Under the oddity of 12.02 is, it has a series of presumptions. The primary one, but is not classified at the high point of the hierarchy, is the presumption of paternity based upon being married to somebody. But below that, you have an acknowledgement of paternity. You have the permission to put your name on the birth certificate. In each of those, you're going to have the same problem as you could have in the same case, three different parents with conflicting presumptions, which is the problem, of course, that one faces. If one wants to look at this, what they have done is to resurrect Lord Mansfield rule with a vigilance that one would never have expected after Davis against Davis, because it will operate to bar the whole world, according to their brief, if there is this offhand determination with the child unrepresented that the child is indeed the child of the husband in the divorce case. Total preclusive effect. Now here we have, of course, the problem that when one looks at the code itself, we have to decide with this strange collection of presumptions and the preclusive effect of section 13.44 of the code, which says that this is going to operate to bar any other claim if there has been a determination, that is their principal claim, which was the claim in the trial court, i.e. that the trial court itself made a determination. Our position is there was no determination, unless one says that there was indeed if they did not actually adjudicate the issue. If the issue was not raised, we say it was not adjudicated, and we have to raise the issue at a later time. Thank you, Your Honor.
You've got four more minutes.
Your Honors, at the risk of insulting the court, I'm going to sacrifice it.
Okay, well, let me just ask you one more question. If we find that the children's suit is not barred by either res judicata or the section 1344 of the family code we were just discussing, do we need to reach any other issue in this case?
Just a remand to the trial court, Your Honor, in order to be reached, to be tried.
Is the outcome in this case, you've referenced JWP.
Yes.
We're going to hear argument, of course, on it in a minute. But is the outcome in this case determinative of JWP?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, depending upon how Your Honor should approach the case or this court should approach the case. JWT obviously involves a complete stranger, just as the state was a complete stranger. The only thing which is different about ours is not a stranger in the sense that our clients, these children, Alex and Austin, were, quote, involved, quote, in the trial court. That is, they were actually mentioned in a decree, which kicks us over into 1344 in a sense that JWT and Gibson are not kicked over into it. That is, JWT follows much closer, in our opinion, to Levan in terms of the interest that is involved in it, because there you have a true stranger to the judgment. So if Your Honors were to make that kind of distinction, it would be inappropriate. You could actually distinguish the two cases.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from the response.
May it please the court, Mr. John Sampson will present argument for the response.
Is there any dispute as to who the biological father is?
Well, Your Honor, may I please report? It's true that in the dismissal, the pleadings are asserted. On the other hand, our position is there is a father, an adjudicated biological father. His name is Thornweb Dreyer. And so there's already a decision by a court of competent jurisdiction naming an individual as the biological father of these children. That happens to be the husband of the mother. And that final decision It is not before us. We are not here on a bill of review. That's not on appeal. So to that extent, our position is, of course, that there is a biological father, and his name is Thornweb Dreyer, and he has been that in that position since 1987. Before that time, he was a presumed father. So this case is not the expansive case trying to deal with all sorts of hypotheticals that petitioners would have it. It's a very narrow case. It's about the divorce of a couple in which the court has jurisdiction over all parties over the issue. The suit affecting the parent-child relationship is determined in 1987 by the trial court, which finds that the three children born to the mother during the marriage are issue of the marriage, and that in naming Thornweb Dreyer as a parent, he's not an adoptive parent, he is the biological father. Indeed, the family code under 1101 defines a parent, the male parent, as the biological father, who is either presumed or adjudicated. Now, in this case, we have an adjudicated biological father, and so all this discussion about...
Was paternity contested in that proceeding?
No, sir.
Judge Gammon raised as an issue. Really.
The mother of the children filed a sworn petition pleading that her husband was the father of the children, and the court, based on the pleadings and the evidence, found that that was the case, ordered the father to pay child support.
Was it contested? Did he contest it?
He made no appearance in the trial court.
And you're arguing that that should preclude these children or someone in behalf of these children.
That's
from
correct.
Establishing paternity in someone that they believe is the biological father.
There's two things. Yes, the mother has brought the case as the children's next friend, as if she had no part in the original determination. We do say, yes, the children are bound by this first determination.
Of course, we're engaging in a legal fiction when we allow the mother to do that. We are also engaging in legal fiction when you say it's been litigated.
It has been litigated, Your Honor, because he was served. He participated in that first trial in the sense that there was a property division, there was child support ordered, and so forth. Thereafter, there were two subsequent actions in this.
Was it a waiver or a default?
He made no appearance.
He filed no answer.
He made no, yeah, that's correct, Your Honor.
It was a default.
But it's not a default in this context is not as if he hadn't been served and paid no attention to the lawsuit, since it's clear that there was a property division that divided property between the parties, and then subsequently there were two
actions. I understand
actions.
How that can be binding on the husband and the wife, adults.
Yes.
I'm not sure, I'm persuaded that it can be binding on minors.
You have identified correctly the basic issue here, Judge Gamage, is the mother's action, is the action of the parents, particularly the parent who is now asserting a different claim on behalf of the children, is that binding on the parent, on the children? That is, are those children bound by the prior decision? That is the basic question.
And why should it be?
Because the public policy has been determined by the state of Texas, by the legislature, not in this building, but across the street. There are a number of family code provisions that give the answer to whether Texas has chosen to put the children in privity with their parents and to end subsequent litigation. And so, insofar as there is a wide variety of cases cited by petitioners from New Jersey, Missouri, etc., those are not really relevant to our situation if we have an answer provided by our family code. So all of the cases that have gone before that deal with presumptions of unlitigated issues, like Levan, like Espercua, which was cited to this court yesterday by petitioners. All of those cases cited are about cases in which there had been no prior adjudication of paternity. The case today that you'll immediately hear after this case, JWT, is about an unadjudicated paternity claim. The only case that is cited by petitioners that deals with an adjudicated paternity case is the Attorney General versus Ridge, which was clearly distinguished and is clearly distinguishable by the Court of Appeals, by the First District Court up in Houston. Ridge was a situation in which the husband of the mother fraudulently claimed sterility. The mother accepted that claim, and subsequently the children, and there was no determination of paternity. So subsequently, a suit was brought as Nick's friend on behalf of the children. That suit was a bill of review based on the fraud of the husband of the mother. And in that case, there was no named individual adjudicated as the biological father. So Section 1344, which is a key determination by the legislature that answers how many times do you litigate parentage, that was not involved in Ridge because there was no named biological father as there is here. So,
Mr. Sampson, assuming that this action is not barred, what are we to do with Section 12.06, which requires the express statement denying paternity in the spouse's pleadings in a suit that attempts to rebut the presumption of paternity?
Your Honor, I don't believe that that's before us. If that were before us, if that was necessary to answer this case, then I would be happy to speculate on what one should do with 1206 and whether the husband or the wife or other party or other persons may assert that claim. Now, that claim was dealt with in Attorney General versus Levan, in which you can join everybody in a one lawsuit effort, and therefore the issue of assertion of husband, assertion of wife of the 1206 rebuttal of the presumption could be involved, but it's not involved here.
But in Levan, we found that, we said that that requirement was satisfied by the express statement in the pleadings denying the presumption of paternity by one of the spouses, or both of the spouses in that case. Here, once we got beyond the hurdle of the binding effect of the divorce decree, wouldn't we be confronted with that same question, whether the spouses had expressly denied paternity in this case?
I agree, Justice Cornyn, that if you get beyond the fact that the parent's action bind the children, if you get beyond the legislative determination that the children and the parents are in privity, that is Section 1204, subsection 7, provides that the children are bound by the legal decisions that the parents may make legal decisions on behalf of the children. Now, twice in this fall session, this court has spoken at length about res judicata and collateral estoppel. And I'd like to look very briefly at your two decisions, the first one being Barr versus Resolution Trust Corporation, and there you reviewed the history of res judicata, indicating that there are two aspects to it, claims preclusion and issue preclusion. The more important case, in my view, for this particular issue before you is the Getty Oil versus INA case, which was decided issued just 2 weeks ago. There are two important quotes. One is about res judicata, one is about collateral estoppel, and to that extent, we need to see if those two quotes apply in this case. First of all, if res judicata, quote, precludes a second action by the parties in their privies, not only on matters actually litigated, but also on cause of actions or defenses which arise out of the same subject matter and which might have been litigated in the first suit. That's the res judicata. On the collateral estoppel, you stated The doctrine of collateral estoppel precludes relitigation of ultimate issues of fact actually litigated and essential to the judgment in a prior suit. If I may, let us look at the answers that the Family Code gives us, that the public policy of Texas gives us by virtue of those we elect to decide that public policy. Are the parents and the children in privity? Is Mrs. Dreyer a party to that first action, indeed to the first three actions, the Sapser and two subsequent contempt proceedings? Obviously, there's no claim that Mrs. Dreyer is not bound. The question is, are the children bound? Are those children who were 3 years old at the time of the first suit and are now, by thanks to this process, eight, are they bound? And citing cases from other states doesn't help us. Citing a majority and minority rule doesn't help us. What helps us is the fact that states are free to choose their own public policy in this regard, and what Michigan and Missouri and New Jersey do is irrelevant. Absent a constitutional offense, our legislature can decide, and the legislature's made its choice. Legislature says that a parent is a man adjudicated to be a biological father, 1101. And Thorne Dreyer has been adjudicated to be a parent, and therefore adjudicated to be a biological father, the biological father. You only get one in life.
The children could file an action to set that shot, I suppose.
In a bill of review, Your Honor, we're not here on that, so I will try not to speculate as to the broad sweep of an opinion that can and should be very narrowly focused on the exact issue before the court.
We must consider also, however, the effects of our ruling.
I understand, Your Honor.
Looking down the road, I suppose the children could file a bill of review and have that determination set aside, and if they did, then not only they, but the mother could then file another action against Mr. Green.
The difficulty with that, given the Ridge case, is that the fraud in the Ridge case was perfectrated by the biological father, husband of the mother.
They may not be able to prove it, but they could attempt it.
In this case, there is no fraud. There's no fraud alleged by the biological father, a third party. There's no fraud alleged by the husband. The only fraud, if any, is by the next friend, the mother. So I just can't. I don't believe that we ought to speculate on the broad sweep when this case can be very narrowly decided.
That you have referred to this public policy decision absent constitutional deficiency, and of course there are alleged constitutional deficiencies with reference to Section 1344 in this case. How can that Section 1344 stand even under a rational basis?
Well, Your Honor, a far more severe restriction on both the child and the alleged biological father was sustained by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Michael H. case. And in that particular case, the child, Victoria, was found not to have a claim to establish a, quote, second father, a biological father. She had already had a father, and in that circumstance, neither a due process, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected both a claim of equal protection and of due process, and in that case, there had been no adjudication that her presumed father, the mother's husband, was actually the biological father. In this case, we have such an adjudication. So petitioners put great weight on the fact that there was no attorney ad litem. Well, in fact, there was none. That's discretionary. That's a choice by the legislature. In addition, the children got an attorney ad litem appointed in this case. That attorney ad litem, guardian ad litem, who was an attorney, urged dismissal. We're still here despite the fact that the children's guardian urged dismissal of this suit. So 12047 provides the privity necessary for the res judicata, the claims preclusion. And then we can go to the collateral estoppel. That is, does the determination below has stopped these children or indeed anybody else once you have an adjudication. Well, first of all, insofar as the claim that we have a default judgment or the father made no appearance, he made no appearance in the initial suit, but he made appearances thereafter in two contempt proceedings in which he was adjudicated and finally made a adjudicated to be in contempt and then finally made a settlement of a lump sum for child support, at which time it turned out that the settlement was some land that wasn't worth anything because of a tax lien, and so this suit was filed. Now, there were three actions against the father. That's actual litigation. That's in each and every instance, it is essential to the decision of child support and parentage that he be the biological father. Only a parent has a duty to support. So those issues were essentially litigated. Now, when we get to 1344, it says that you can't bring a parentage action, a Chapter 13 action, a paternity suit, if you will, if there is a named individual who has been declared to be the biological father of the child. 1344 is the legislative determination that once you get to this stage, once you have an answer given as to who the biological father is, that ends it. That is a preclusion. It's like a trespass to tribe title. It is the issue preclusion that is necessary to collaterally stop these children and anybody else. And this case is wholly distinguishable from the cases in which there has been no adjudication or in which there's been fraud that amounts to a bill of review, would permit a bill of review. So what do we have here? We have the same thing that we had in Michael H. A child is entitled to, and the public policy pushes in every way possible for the establishment of a parentage, male and female. But Victoria was entitled to one father. Alexander and Austin are entitled to one father, and they have been awarded that one father by a court of competent jurisdiction. And that ends it.
Does it make any difference if it's the wrong one?
That question asks the question that's fundamental to the principles of res judicata and collateral estoppel. When you have a final decision, is it important that that decision is right or wrong? Do you investigate the correctness of an answer given finally? Insofar as I can determine, looking at Getty Oil, looking at the Bar versus Resolution Trust, I do not discover an indication that if you meet all of the terms of collateral estoppel or of res judicata, that the question of was it correctly decided is before the court. Rather, right or wrong, was it decided, and was it decided finally?
We have a different conception of the importance of finality in criminal law, for instance.
Yes, we do, Your Honor.
Ordinary civil law. Is it possible that we have the same different conception in family law, not only because of the best interest of the child interest, but also because of actual constitutional right that the children may have?
One could ask that. One could. You did ask that question, Your Honor, and the answer given is the answer given by the U.S. Supreme Court in Michael H. with regard to is this claim that Victoria, that Alexander, that Austin raised about identifying, quote, their true, correct biological father, is that a question of constitutional dimension? Is the child denied equal protection or due process? And the Supreme Court of the United States makes a resounding no to that question.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready for any rebuttal argument.
May I please the court?
Much has been made of finality here. Justice Heck inquired about could there be a bill of review brought subsequently. Not only that, the state could bring an action here. If we lose in this case, the state may bring an action under Levan. There's no question about that under Levan. They were not a party to this proceeding, so there's no end to that. A bill of review could be brought by a child up to the point that it's past the age of 18 when it achieves majority. If there were a person now who filed an affidavit of parenthood under 12.02, an affidavit of paternity, just a simple affidavit of paternity, that person could presumably be a presumed father as well. There is simply no end to the difficulties encountered in trying to say that 1344 bars the world. If 1344 bars the world, we suddenly have an in rem action, which I didn't know really existed, except in the case of a libel of a ship. If preclusive effect were to be given to the original divorce decree, in which we have this incidental mention of the fact that Thorndryer is the parent and the child was born during the marriage, we're trying to say that Yeti Oil, which your honors just decided, is going to extend to a non-party. Your whole question here is, are the children bound? If one says that they are bound, you simply have not foreclosed the possibility of further suits down the road. These will continue forever until such time, I suppose, as it could be established. The children, if they were to fail here, could find another biological father. The issue of finality here is a false issue. There is no finality as far as family law is concerned anymore. There never has been if you assume that biology has achieved the constitutional importance that it has. If you say that 1344 has preclusive effect, you encounter the most serious due process problems that Justice Doggett and Justice Gamage seem to be raising. We're saying that...
Now, those constitutional issues were not litigated or brought to the attention of the trial court.
They were unable to, Your Honor. We simply brought the suit. If they were to be raised, the only first time we could raise them would be on appeal after there was a dismissal of our suit, unless Your Honor would require us to file a motion for new trial, which, of course, is not required when you're appealing from the finding. As the point is raised, Your Honor's granted issue on this, granted writ on this issue, of course, that our failure, the Court of Appeals held that our failure to raise this issue meant that we had waived it, but there was no opportunity to raise it unless it would be required that we conceded that we were barred and then said it's unconstitutional. We have never claimed to have raised it in the trial court, except incidentally, which of course everybody was aware of, but there was no issue raised and there was no opportunity to raise it until such time as we took it up on appeal.
If you're correct, is the only way that the divorce decree will be a binding determination of paternity is if the trial court appoints a guardian ad litem?
No, Your Honor. Indeed, the opposite is true. If you appoint a guardian ad litem to litigate in every case, then you could, I suppose, have the guardian ad litem raising the issue of paternity, filing citation by publication upon all possible fathers or something of this kind. If the question is left open, we're exactly where we are now. There's no real problem that exists because the child's rights are retained. The only way it can be raised is under 1206, as the court has already inquired about, as Your Honor inquired about. The only two people who can raise it in the trial court in the divorce case presently are under 1206 are the husband and the wife, and either of them can raise it. But if there can be an intervention, if, for example, Mr. Gibson were to intervene in the divorce involving the child JWT, under their theory of the case, there would be no way for that to occur. Or if the state were to intervene to attempt to establish in that case that the husband was not the father, under their theory of the case, there would be none. And Your Honor's opinion expressly said that this way we have continuity. Is this establishing paternity? And establishing paternity means that there is at least a continuum as far as presumed parentage, which is what one would find. And then if we establish that indeed Mr. Green is the father of these children, then we've solved that problem. But to attempt to extrapolate beyond this and to say that there is some point in time at which we can say everything is going to be final is to defy reality. There are too many families these days, this entire court, I'm sure, as friends, perhaps family, in which these unorthodox lifestyles exist. I mean, we all see it every day, and it's been true since biblical times, as far as I can see. Family unity was gone with Cain and Abel, as far as I can see, and it hasn't changed much a great deal since. But if one wants to preach family unity, to say that we're going to deny the children the right to establish the paternity of their father, who is someone who is impregnated a married woman, family integrity is lost already. It seems to me that that's the antithesis of family integrity.
What's the effect of it on adoptions, where the adopted child seeks to establish the who the biological parent is at some later date? I mean, is that disestablish the legal paternity of its adopted parent?
Your Honor, the effect on adoptions has been the same since the early 60s when Armstrong against Manzo went to the Supreme Court of the United States. The difficulty always was is that we operated there on a series of presumptions. That is, we presumed something. The mother was the only person who had to give consent. The father was unfit, and his consent was waived if indeed he did not pay child support. If 1344 operates here, there is a determination of paternity. That's one thing. But there is nothing to preclude a true biological father from coming in and attacking an adoption at a later time. Now, 1344 cannot reach that far, I do not believe, because the ordinary adoption will have an affidavit of status. It will have service of process upon whoever is named by the mother. Again, the mother controls. The French say that maternity is fact, paternity is opinion. And there's some truth to that. But certainly when you rely upon something such as an affidavit of status executed by the mother, just as in this case, there are mixed motives. In the divorce, she had a conflict of interest. You can say she has a conflict of interest here. Rule 44 says that she can sue as guardian ad litem. Rule 173 says if there is indeed a conflict of interest, disqualify her and substitute somebody else. She was never disqualified in the trial court. A guardian ad litem, attorney ad litem was appointed, but she has remained the next friend of the children. Until such time as she is disqualified, she stands in that surrogate capacity, in our opinion.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief
audience. Please rise.